May it please your lordship, gentlemen of the jury, the prisoner in the dock stands before you charged with the murder of his wife, Julia Elizabeth Mary Bickley. The motive for this appalling crime, as I shall make abundantly clear to you by the evidence of Mrs. Madeline Bourne, who was then Miss Madeline Cranmere, was sexual passion. A passion for the then Miss Cranmere. A desire to marry Miss Cranmere so strong, so violent, that the accused was ready to go to any lengths whatsoever, was willing to commit murder in order to rid himself of his legal wife and be free to marry Miss Cranmere. However, it was not until several weeks after he had decided to murder his wife that the accused took any active steps in the matter. Murder is a serious business. The slightest slip may be disastrous. Dr. Bickley had no intention of risking disaster.
We present the final episode of Malice Aforethought by Francis Iles, dramatized in four parts by Philip Mackey and adapted for radio by Gordon House. With Paul Eddington as Dr. Bickley, Kim Braden as Madeline, Alan Dudley as Devereaux, and Madeline Smith as Ivy.
Well, we can congratulate ourselves so far, I think. Yes, certainly.
Congratulate ourselves? What on?
Well, on a very fair opening. Scrupulously fair. Sir Bernard let you down quite lightly, don't you think? He's the Attorney General, you know.
God.
But I'm sorry to hear her husband's ill.
Who?
Mr. Bourne.
Denny?
Very ill, apparently. He's got typhoid fever.
I warned her. I told them a dozen times those drains at the hall needed redoing completely.
He may even be dead by now, which would be disastrous for us.
Why?
Well, recently a bereaved widow always has an effect on a jury. Oh, well, let's hope it doesn't happen. But apart from that, really, Bickley, I must say, yes, every confidence, every confidence.
I swear by Almighty God that the evidence which I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God.
Your full name is Madeline Mary Sinclair Bourne.
Yes.
You are the widow of Dennis Herbert Blaisbourne.
Yes.
The very recent widow, I believe. When, in fact, did your husband die?
Yesterday.
With the greatest sympathy, Mrs. Bourne, what did he die of?
Typhoid fever.
And what age was he?
24.
The same age as yourself, I believe.
Yes.
How long had you been married, Mrs. Bourne?
14 months.
Mrs. Bourne, may I say how much sympathy the court feels for you and how much gratitude we have for your public-spiritedness in coming here to give evidence at this time of your great bereavement?
Thank you, my lord.
We shall try not to distress you. Do please take your time.
Thank you.
Mrs. Bourne, may I ask you to cast your mind back to the summer of 1927... when I believe you bought a house called The Hall at Wyvern's Cross.
Yes.
You were then unmarried and your name was Madeline Cranmere.
Yes.
After your arrival at Wyvern's Cross, did you make the acquaintance of Dr. Bickley and his wife?
Yes, I did.
And what impressions did you form of them?
Mrs. Bickley, Julia, I thought a saintly woman. I admired her enormously.
Hmm. And Dr. Bickley, the accused?
At first I thought him quite a nice little man, not worthy of his wife, but quite nice.
Quite a nice little man. And did you ever have occasion to revise that opinion?
Yes.
Would you mind describing to the court the events which caused you to revise that opinion?
He came to the hall one day, and he brought some sketches he had done to show me. Then he asked if he could make a sketch of me. The sketch was only to be of my face. After a while, he expressed dissatisfaction with his efforts.
What did he say? Do you remember?
He said, "Oh, God, you're so beautiful, I can't get anywhere near you." And then he threw down his crayon and advanced on me.
Oh, right. Mrs. Bourne, I must ask you, what happened then?
He tried to kiss me.
You let me kiss you?
And what did you do?
I turned my head away in fright.
Liar!
And escaped out of the room as soon as I could.
You were frightened.
I was terrified. I was very young and completely inexperienced then. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I was terrified.
Julia was right. She's a hypocrite.
And what did you do as a result of this unpleasant incident?
I ceased to employ Mr. Bickley as my medical adviser.
But did you continue to meet Dr. Bickley socially?
In such a small village, it was impossible not to.
And what was his attitude to you when you met?
He never ceased to make advances to me.
I realize that this must be very painful to you, Mrs. Bourne, but I think it's your duty to tell us. What form did these advances take?
He wanted me to be his mistress. I, of course, told him that such a thing would be unthinkable. Then he wanted me to marry him. I pointed out that he had a wife already. Then he said he would get a divorce from his wife. I explained that my religious beliefs made it out of the question for me to marry a divorced man.
In other words, his passion for you was such that he was willing to stop at nothing to satisfy his desires.
That is how it seemed to me.
Turning to the day on which Mrs. Bickley died, would you give us an account of the events of that day?
In the morning of that day, Denny, that is, the late Mr. Bourne, came to call on me and proposed to me. I accepted him. We became engaged. We were very happy.
I am deeply sorry that we must remind you of your loss. Would you like to pause for a moment?
No, I'll go on.
Thank you.
At about tea time, Dr. Bickley drove up to the hall. I asked Denny to meet him and tell him of our engagement. He did so. But Dr. Bickley forced his way past him into the house, into my bedroom, where he proposed marriage to me once again.
And what did you say to him?
I didn't want a row on such a happy day for me. I was tactful. I referred to the fact that he was married already.
You referred to the fact that he was married already. Kindly tell us what he replied to that.
He said, Julia is dead.
That's it then. I've lost the case.
Now, Mrs. Bourne, it distresses me to have to intrude on your great sorrow.
Thank you.
But there are one or two questions I simply must ask you. You have told us of Dr. Bickley's attempt to kiss you when you were alone with him.
Yes.
And afterwards, I think you met him only socially.
Yes.
You were never alone with him?
Never.
But Dr. Bickley, I believe you said, did not cease to make advances to you.
Yes.
In the presence of others?
Yes.
Did you tell Dr. Bickley that you were in love with the man who later became your husband?
No.
Could you tell us why not?
I was concerned only to repel his advances.
Yes, of course, I quite understand. Were not you and your husband a few months ago contemplating a divorce?
Certainly not.
You swear to that?
Really, Sir Francis, is this relevant?
Oh, quite, Your Lordship. It will be apparent in a moment. Do you swear to that, Mrs. Bourne?
Certainly I do.
But like most married couples, you had your quarrels.
We had only been married 14 months.
As if you wouldn't mind answering my question, Mrs. Bourne.
If I must, the answer is no. My husband and I never quarreled.
No, didn't you? Ha, ha.
But like most women, you had your moments of jealousy, hmm?
Certainly not. My husband never gave me cause for such a thing.
You never expressed jealousy of the women your husband had been fond of before he met you? I'm afraid I must press you for an answer, Mrs. Bourne.
No, never.
Perhaps you will tell me that you did not keep him up till 4 o'clock in the morning, for weeks on end, till his health was seriously affected, while you raved at him about women he'd loved before he even knew of your existence.
Sir Francis, I must ask you to justify this remarkable line of cross-examination.
Well, certainly, my lord. My cross-examination is directed to establish that the evidence given by this witness is totally unreliable. That she is notoriously untruthful, malicious, and mentally unbalanced. And I intend to call evidence of my own to prove this.
Bantam, I could kiss you.
You realize, of course, what you are doing, Sir Francis.
Perfectly, my lord. My client is prepared to face any questions of a personal nature. He has nothing to conceal.
Nevertheless, I think I will adjourn the court now, to give you an opportunity to think things over.
That is very kind of your lordship. I am much indebted.
She's mad. I told you so a dozen times.
And the beauty of the position is that now they're entitled to attack your personal character, but to do so will only damage their own case.
How's that?
Well, there's nothing for them to attack you on except your somewhat, well, shall we say, indiscriminate relations with women? It won't benefit them at all to show you as indiscriminate. Their whole case rests on your affection, your passion for one single woman. The more women, the less motive.
Yes, of course.
Chadford's evidence will be all innuendo, so we don't have to worry about him.
He's alive, then?
Oh, yes, completely recovered. But it'll be quite obvious to the jury that his attacks on you were motivated by petty jealousy.
And as for that deranged woman...
Yes. I fancy we've seen the end of Mrs. Bourne.
A medical certificate.
What?
Saying that Mrs. Bourne...
Could we have it a little louder, please, so that we can all hear?
A medical certificate saying that Mrs. Bourne is in bed, suffering from nervous prostration and shock. She is not in a fit state to attend the court.
Ah, thank you. What a shame.
So she's a coward as well as a bitch. You'll have to do better than that, Deverell.
Your name is Hubert Henry Ryder.
It is.
And you are the official bacteriologist of the Home Office.
I am.
Were you given a culture for examination on the 18th of August, 1929... taken from an incubator in Dr. Bitley's house?
I was.
Would you tell the court what you discovered with regard to the culture submitted to you for examination?
The medium submitted to me for examination was an ordinary gelatin plate. There were several colonies on the plate, all presenting the thin, notched, irregular appearance of the colon typhoid group. I identified Bacillus coli communis, Bacillus typhosus, and others of the same group. Bacillus enteritidis very decidedly predominated.
I believe you also examined the residue of a jar of potted meat, which was found in Dr. Bickley's dustbin.
I did. The potted meat contained Bacillus enteritidis only.
Perhaps you would explain to the court the leading characteristics of this bacillus.
Certainly. Bacillus enteritidis is a leading member of the large colon typhoid group. As regards its morphology, it is actively motile, carries several flagellae, forms...
I wonder... If you could manage to put it a little less technically, Doctor. I was meaning more particularly its effects on the human frame.
Oh, sorry. Well, it is established now that Bacillus enteritidis is a very frequent cause of meat poisoning, resulting in enteric or typhoid fever. Symptoms are due to the action of the toxins. Their onset is generally rapid, not to say sudden.
And these symptoms are?
Vomiting, diarrhea, pains in the abdomen and head, prostration, collapse, cold sweats, vigors, cramps, rashes, and deferred tongue.
Thank you, Doctor. Now, you have heard Mrs. Bourne's and Mr. Chatford's symptoms described. Is it your opinion that these are consistent with poisoning by Bacillus enteritidis.
Enteritidis, yes. Entirely consistent. Hmm.
Did you examine the gelatin plate also for Bacillus botulinus, the germ which causes the disease known as botulism?
I did.
Did you find any?
None.
That's odd.
Could you have expected to do so?
No.
Why not?
Bacillus botulinus is anaerobic. That is to say, it dies if exposed to the air. The medium as prepared was suitable for aerobic organisms only. Bacillus botulinus could not possibly have survived.
Thank you, Dr. Ryder.
Well, I'm damned. So I gave them typhoid, not botulism. Just as well it didn't kill them, or things might now be looking very nasty.
Your name is John Jeremiah Pym, and you are senior official analyst to the Home Office.
Yes.
Would you tell the court what you found in the organs of the deceased, Mrs. Julia Bickley?
No trace of any poison at all.
None?
The morphia, which it was admitted in evidence that Mrs. Bickley had been taking in such large quantities, would in any case have disappeared after such a lapse of time, as would any other vegetable poison. Of any metallic poison, such as arsenic, I could find no trace whatsoever.
And no trace of any metallic substances?
I found vanadium in surprisingly large quantities, and a very little gold. I was quite unable to account for the presence of these two, which are so rarely used in medicine.
But did, eventually, the combination suggest something to you?
Yes, it did. That occurred to my memory by a curious chance. A proprietary preparation which appeared a few years ago, and which in the course of my duties I was called on to analyse.
Oh, God.
This preparation, known as Farolite, was one of the many proprietary medicines designed to correct uric acid diathesis. Now, this particular preparation was not a success, and the profession did not take it up, as it was apt to induce violent headaches.
Oh, God. They know exactly what I did. I'm done for.
Any point in going on with it? In dragging out the proceedings?
My dear fellow.
That evidence about Farolite. It looked very black.
It's the prosecution's job to make things look black. Just wait till Sir Francis gets going. You'll see how white he makes them. And your evidence, my dear Bickley, will be the clincher.
I swear by Almighty God that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Dr. Bickley, did you administer to your wife the dose of morphia which killed her?
No, I did not.
But you had previously administered morphia to her?
Yes, once or twice, to alleviate the pain of the headaches from which she suffered.
How long had your wife been suffering from these headaches?
For about a year, but they grew progressively more frequent and more painful.
And you had, I believe, been giving her a proprietary medicine called Farolite.
Yes, she suffered from an excess of uric acid. The Farolite was used to control this.
Did you connect the Farolite with the headaches your wife was having?
No, I did not. She'd had headaches before I ever gave her Farolite.
Or did you consult any doctor for a second opinion on your wife's headaches?
Yes, we went to see Sir Taberton Folliot in Harley Street.
And what did he give as his opinion?
He thought the whole trouble was caused by sepsis of the tonsils.
And did your wife, as a result of Sir Tamerton's opinion, have her tonsils out?
No, she had a horror of surgery. It was impossible to make her change her mind.
Mm. Now, can we turn to the question of Miss Cranmere, as Mrs. Bourne then was? When you first met her, what did you think of her?
I thought she was a very attractive young woman. And I thought it might be amusing to flirt with her.
Had you flirted with other young women before in the Wyvern's Cross area during the time of your marriage?
Yes, I had.
More than one?
Many more than one.
Did your wife know of these flirtations?
Oh, yes. Julia and I were the greatest of pals. I used to tell her everything. We used to have a good laugh over it.
And equally, you gave her all the details of your flirtation with Miss Cranmere.
Absolutely. Blow by blow.
Now, turning to the day of your wife's death, when did you last see her alive?
Let me think. The clock in the hall was striking the half hour as I went into the drawing room to say goodbye to Julia.
Goodbye?
I was off on my rounds.
Ah. And how did your wife seem to you that last time you saw her?
She looked as if she had one of her headaches coming on.
Well, did you do anything about it to alleviate the pain?
No.
Why not?
She'd so often refused the normal analgesic drugs like aspirin. She said they didn't suit her. And morphia I would not give her for her own good.
You would not give it to her. But she was taking it for herself.
Yes.
So you went on your rounds. And then you went to call on Miss Cranmere.
Yes.
Why?
I thought a little flirtation might do me good after the labours of the day.
And what happened at Miss Cranmere's house?
I met firstly with Mr. Bourne, who told me he'd become engaged to Miss Cranmere. I wasn't greatly pleased at the news, well, since obviously it meant an end to our flirtation, for the time being, at least. But I congratulated him, and then went into the house to congratulate her.
And how did Miss Cranmere take this?
She seemed very disappointed that I didn't wish to make a scene, to shout and scream in an emotional way, as if she'd broken my heart. She became quite hysterical on this point. I'd always suspected her of hysterical tendencies.
Did you, at any point in this conversation with Miss Cranmere, propose marriage to her?
No, certainly not.
Did Miss Cranmere remind you that you were already married?
No, absolutely not.
And did you yourself say Julia is dead?
That is a damned lie.
Dr. Bickley.
I beg your pardon, my lord.
Thank you, Dr. Bickley.
Dr. Bickley, on the day of your wife's death, you left the house to go on your rounds at just after 2:30?
Yes.
And then you drove out of the drive of your house, turned right and turned right again, into the lane, which runs alongside your garden on the west side of your house.
Yes.
And when you were in the lane, your engine, to put it in the common parlance, conked out.
Yes, it did.
At a spot precisely opposite the side door of your house, giving access to your surgery with its syringes and its morphia.
At roughly that spot, yes.
And no one was around to see your car conk out.
No, no one but myself.
So you would have been able, without anyone seeing you, to go through your garden to your side door and get into your surgery and get back again to your car, still without anyone seeing you.
I would hypothetically have been able.
I suggest that that, in fact, was what you did. And that while you were in the house, you gave your wife the fatal injection.
That is totally untrue. It would have demanded greater time than I had at my disposal.
Splendid. You were splendid.
I fancy I gave as good as I got.
You certainly did.
Yes, I beat him in his own game, eh?
And the rest of it should be pretty straightforward. Just one more witness to stop up one more little hole.
It's very good of you to come forward, Mrs. Chatford.
Very good of you indeed. Especially in view of your husband's role in this case. Very independent-minded of you. Now, would you tell the court what happened to you on the day of Mrs. Bickley's death?
Oh, God, she knows. She knows I killed Julia. She knows.
That afternoon, I was walking along the lane, which runs by the side of Dr. Bickley's house and garden, when I saw Dr. Bickley's car standing in the lane. Dr. Bickley was turning the handle to try and get it to start. I stopped to talk to him. He got the car to start, and he offered me a lift. I refused, because I was out for a walk. He said goodbye and drove off.
What time did this happen, Mrs. Chatford?
It was 3:25.
And we already have evidence, my lad, that it was after 2:30 when Dr. Bickley left the house, and there would not have been enough time between just after 2:30 and 3:25.
Yes, yes, I'm sure the jury will have taken your point. Is that all?
That is all, my lad.
Mrs. Chatford, how did you know that it was 3:25?
Ivy, don't give me away. Ivy, I love you.
Dr. Bickley looked at his watch and told me what the time was.
So your only knowledge of what the time was Dr. Bickley's telling you. Had you any means of checking that he was telling you the right time?
Ivy, I'll marry you. I'll kill Chatford and we'll live happily ever after.
Oh, yes. I had a watch of my own.
Did you look at it?
Yes, I did.
And what time did it say?
It said 3:25.
Do you swear to that?
I swear to it.
There is no possibility of your having been mistaken?
None whatsoever. My watch keeps very good time.
Congratulations, my dear Bickley. Oh, not that there was any doubt at all about the verdict.
Well, it's been a very fair trial on the whole, I must say. Very fair. Apart from one or two times when the prosecution seemed to go beyond its proper limits. But I suppose that always happens. Now, lead me to the Black Maria. Or am I going to get a drink first? I could use one. Ah, perhaps the superintendent will oblige.
Edmund Alfred Bickley, I now charge you with the willful murder of Dennis Herbert Blaise Bourne by administering to him the germs of typhoid fever, to wit, bacillus enteritidis, on the 15th of August, 1929.
What?
You're not obliged to say anything unless you wish to, but whatever you say will be taken down in writing and may be given in evidence.
You bastard!
Mr. Foreman, have you all agreed upon your verdict?
We have.
Do you find the prisoner at the bar, Edmund Alfred Bickley, guilty or not guilty of the willful murder of Dennis Herbert Blaise Bourne?
Guilty.
And that is the verdict of you all.
It is.
But I didn't do it. I didn't do it. It was the drains that gave him typhoid, not me. I warned her. I was the one who warned her. It was the drains.
Prisoner at the bar, have you anything to say why the court should not give you judgment of death according to law?
Yes, I didn't do it.
Edmund Alfred Bickley, the jury having found you guilty of the willful murder of Dennis Herbert Blaise Bourne, I shall waste no more words on you in passing upon you the sentence of death prescribed by the law. The sentence of the court upon you is that you be taken from this place to a lawful prison.
I didn't do it!
And thence to a place of execution.
I did not do it! I'm not guilty!
And that you be hanged by the neck until you be dead. And may the Lord have mercy on your soul.
Oh. I did not do it!
I did not do it. I didn't do it.
In the final part of Malice Aforethought by Francis Iles, dramatized by Philip Mackey, Paul Eddington was Dr. Bickley and Kim Braden Madeline. Deverell was played by Alan Dudley, Ivy by Madeline Smith, Gun Hill by Alexander John, Bannerton by Garrard Green, and Ryder by Cyril Shapps. Nicholas Courtney was the judge, John Livesey Pym, David Bradshaw the clerk, Christopher Scott the foreman, and Leslie Heritage was Chief Inspector Russell. The sound balance was by Keith Perrin, assisted by Alison Taylor and Andrew Kurofsky. Malice Aforethought was a BBC World Service production adapted and directed by Gordon House.